Peter B. Collins News and Comment. It's Wednesday, April 6, 2016. Merle Haggard has passed away.
I hear people talking bad about the way we have to live here in this country. Harping on the wars we fight, griping about the way things ought to be. And I don't mind them switching sides and standing up for things they believe in. But when they're running down our country, they're walking on the fighting side of me.
Merle Haggard was 79.
On the fighting side of me.
And along with people like Buck Owens.
Running down a way of life, our fighting.
He was an artist who was called Outlaw Country, whatever that means. And Merle Haggard came into San Quentin Prison and did a concert for a nonprofit group I work with called the Freedom Foundation. I decided not to talk politics with him, and he was a guy with a great sense of humor. He loved performing, and we had a great time. He played a lot of great music over the years, some of it with tongue-in-cheek, and his country music fans didn't always get the irony of it. But he was a very interesting guy, and he is no longer with us. I want to open today with an apology. I took yesterday off to go skiing at Lake Tahoe, and on Monday, in my mad dash to leave, I prepared a podcast, I wrote up all the information, it was all ready to go, I just had to click one mouse, and I forgot to do that before I left. So I posted that podcast last evening when I got back from the mountains, and I'm trying to catch up a little bit, but I do apologize for that error. And in that podcast, I took a swipe, at Bernie Sanders. I said, Bernie, release your taxes. There is no explanation that I find acceptable as to why the senator hasn't released his full tax returns. We've seen page 1 and 2 of his 1040 from the year 2014. And while I don't have any suspicions that Bernie has a Panama account, an offshore corporation, or something that will go sideways if he reveals it, there is simply no excuse for him to be the candidate of reform and transparency, and he's not releasing those tax returns. Well, it didn't hurt him in the great state of Wisconsin last night, where he clocked in a nice 56-43 victory over Hillary Clinton. And I was hoping for a bigger margin. This is certainly a healthy win. It was fueled in part by independent voters. But when you look at the breakdown, Bernie Sanders won 63% of the male vote of all ages. He won self-identified liberals by 18 points. He won whites under the age of 45 by 78%. And he tied Hillary Clinton with female votes in the state of Wisconsin. He actually got 50 and she got 49. Now, that's a fascinating formula. And if Sanders is able to keep this up in the big states, including New York and California, he could pull off the upset and dethrone Hillary Clinton by the middle of June. He certainly needs more independent voters, and he needs a larger Democratic turnout. And this is a problem that plagues both Clinton and Sanders going into the fall campaign. Despite the crowds that turn out for Bernie, in all kinds of locations at all hours, he has not been able to show the substantial boost that one would expect from the kind of enthusiasm that he is generating. And so this is a problem for the Democratic Party. Now, the candidates have agreed on a debate in New York next Thursday night, the 14th. And last night on CNN, they reported that insiders at the Clinton campaign have decided that Sanders is enough of a threat that they're taking their white gloves off. Now, I find all this really fascinating and also so distracting, because the Clinton campaign has been using a consistent message for the last 2 weeks that Bernie Sanders has gone too far, that he's gone negative on Hillary. Now, he hasn't run a single negative campaign commercial, and that was his central promise and premise when he launched the campaign. And Sanders has even been hammered because he acknowledged that there are key vulnerabilities of Hillary Clinton that he has chosen not to attack her on. And I criticize Sanders for opting out of discussing the Clinton Foundation and the huge apparent conflicts of interest that it has created, and nobody has even asked Hillary to describe what the role of the Clinton Foundation will be if she goes back to the White House as president and Bill is the first person. And so I have no problem if the Clinton campaign goes completely negative on Bernie Sanders. One of the things they're admitting is that they had tried not to do that because they thought they could beat him without doing it, and they want to try to attract his voters in the fall. But by adopting a scorched earth approach, I still expect Clinton and her surrogates to keep complaining that Sanders has hit her too hard, and that by raising the issues of campaign finance, the money she gets from Wall Street, the, as I've said, a partly unfocused hit on the small amounts of money that she's gotten from people related to fossil fuel industries. But these are the central elements of the Sanders campaign about the rigged system, about the role of money in politics. And she is not above that. In fact, she has huge issues related to her speeches, related to the money that has been put into her campaign by various interest groups. And her supporters claim that that should be off limits for Bernie Sanders. Now, whether it's Trump or Cruz in the fall, neither one will allow any of these things to be off limits. And I argue that it's better for her to respond to these issues now and hope to inoculate voters than to wait for them to be sprung anew in the fall. So one of the things that the Clinton campaign is trying to capitalize on is an interview that was published between Sanders and the editorial board of the New York Daily News. And while some of Bernie's answers don't satisfy me, the way they have cherry-picked this interview and some of Sanders' answers is really troubling. And the Clinton campaign circulated the interview to everybody yesterday. Then her supporters cherry-picked items and tweeted them out, put them up in social media. And I'm really troubled by this report bylined Liz Fields and Sarah Mims at Vice News today, where this appears to be like it came from Blue Nation Review, that captive blog that always parrots the talking points and the latest attack points of the Clinton campaign. And so it reads, "The grilling interview at times left Sanders apparently speechless, telling members of the editorial board that he didn't have an answer." Well, I really appreciate when a candidate says, "I don't have an answer," instead of just making something up, dodging the question, or, you know, just talking a line of bullshit until the question goes away. Here's a, they acknowledge here, in a sign of how damaging the interview could be, the Clinton campaign emailed out the full annotated transcript with the simple comment that it's a must-read for those covering or following the race. And they take out of context a number of the comments that Sanders made. Now, in the interview, the members of the Daily News editorial board made several mistakes of fact. At one point, one of them referred to the time when Sanders was the mayor of Vermont. And he had to correct him and say, "I was the mayor of Burlington." At another point, when they're talking about how Bernie would break up the big banks, he wrote a bill about that, submitted it last year. And his answer paralleled the elements of that bill. But here at the Vice News report, they just pulled out this part. When pressed on what authority Sanders would have to break up the banks and whether the Secretary of Treasury currently has the ability to determine that the banks are too big to fail, he said he didn't know if the Fed has it. Well, it's because the Daily News, one of the members of that editorial board, incorrectly suggested that the Federal Reserve could break up the banks. And Sanders had not argued that, and that's where he said, "I don't know if the Fed has that power," but citing the Dodd-Frank law, he said the administration does. At another point, he was asked a trick question: "Can you name the laws that have been broken or the statutes that you would use to indict bankers on Wall Street?" And he answered, "Do I have them in front of me now, legal statutes? No, I don't. When a company pays a $5 billion fine for something that's illegal, yeah, I think we can bring charges against the executives. And so it is amazing to me that they try to cherry pick these items. And I am linking to the article that kind of breaks down the interview, unpacks it. It's in today's New York Times, written by Peter Evis. And, for example, the article is headlined, "Yes, Bernie Sanders Knows Something About Breaking Up Banks." In the interview, I'm quoting now, with the Daily News editorial board, Sanders does appear to get tangled up in some details and lacks clarity. Breaking up the banks would involve arcane and complex regulatory moves that can trip up any banking policy wonk, let alone a presidential candidate. But taken as a whole, Sanders' answers seem to make sense. Crucially, his answers mostly track with a reasonably straightforward breakup plan that he introduced to Congress last year. And so, I'm not going to read every line here, but I invite you to take a look at this. Because the New York Times has not bent over backwards to be fair to Bernie Sanders. And here, I think it is the competitive juices of taking down the Daily News that have caused them to examine this and publish this analytical piece. And the bottom line is, they say that Sanders does have a command of the issue, even if he may not have performed that well in the interview with the Daily News. On the Republican side last night, Ted Cruz got 48% of the vote in Wisconsin, which is, I think, the biggest margin he's had over Donald Trump, who got 34%. Kasich of Ohio came in at 14% on the Republican side. This does dent the momentum of Trump and increase the likelihood of an open convention. There is also a possible open convention on the Democratic side, too. Don't rule that out. Well, Trump yesterday, trying to add a little depth to one of his most popular message points about his plan to build a big wall along the Mexican border and get Mexico to pay for it, well, he detailed that he's going to use threats to try to get Mexicans to pay for his wall. And he is going to threaten to interrupt or seize some of the money that is transferred from Mexican nationals who are working in the United States, and candidly, many of them are not legal. And on a monthly basis, they wire money to family back in Mexico. It amounts to about $24 billion a year, and it is Mexico's biggest source of hard foreign currency. And so Donald figures, all I got to do is threaten them, and they'll cave, they'll come to the table. But he doesn't think these things through, and clearly his supporters don't either, because by announcing this now, there will be a rush of people who send their remittances to Mexico, and if somehow Trump becomes president next January, they will simply stop sending those remittances. And so he thinks he's got people by the balls, when in fact he doesn't. It's just bluster. And this is what Trump specializes in. And it caused the current president to respond. Obama yesterday said, people expect the president of the United States and elected officials in this country to treat these problems seriously, to put forward policies that have been examined, analyzed, that are effective, and where unintended consequences are taken into account. They don't expect half-baked notions coming out of the White House. We can't afford that. And as I've said over and over again, the idea that the wall will solve any problems is ridiculous. We've already built a fence through, the most easily breached parts of our border. And you can't put a wall up along the Rio Grande. And, you know, there are just a lot of practical issues. And, of course, the other big elephant in this room is that most illegal immigrants these days don't come over the Mexican border. They simply come in at airports. And I don't think Trump's going to build walls there. Well, the Panama Papers scandal is going to be with us for some time. And you may have heard that Iceland's Prime Minister Sigmundur Gunnlaugsson has announced that he will resign his post because it was exposed, despite his protestations that he had moved $4 million in assets into an offshore tax haven. But he has recanted. He has withdrawn his resignation. He is going to step aside for an unspecified amount of time, probably to count his money, But they clarified that he has not resigned and will continue to serve as the leader of his party. So, you know, I don't have a dog in that hunt, but there have been protests, some of the biggest ever in Iceland, and this is just one example of the worldwide grief that is being caused by the release of these papers. And I've linked to a nice summary that The Guardian published today called Panama Papers, The Revelations So Far. And let me just tick off a few of the big items. The offshore trail that they say leads to Vladimir Putin. I still have seen no proof of Putin, and he's probably smart enough to make sure there isn't any. But they claim that his cronies have cobbled together $2 billion, and it's just asserted that it is his or that he has access to this money. Ukraine's Petro Poroshenko, the Candyman, also has accounts there. The law firm helped hide millions. This is the law firm that got exposed here, and they are called Mossack Fonseca. This firm helped launder the cash from Britain's largest gold bullion robbery. Also in Britain, David Cameron, the prime minister, sitting prime minister, his father has been running an offshore fund called Blairmore Holdings that avoided ever having to pay tax in Britain. They did it by hiring a small army of Bahamas residents to sign its paperwork. The leader of FIFA has been pulled into the scandal. The children of Pakistan's Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif have been exposed for offshore companies in the British Virgin Islands. Mossack Fonseca worked with oil firms that were owned by Iran during the sanctions. And the list continues. We're certainly going to hear more about this. And I want to note that Public Citizen, the group that Ralph Nader runs, they've issued a statement. And they take us way, 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 way back to the middle of the Obama administration, about 5 years, when President Obama signed the U.S.-Panama Free Trade Agreement. And at that time, we were told that this was going to be the best way to deal with the offshore tax haven and criminal enterprises that thrive in Panama. And the press release here reads, the top promise about the benefit of the U.S.-Panama Free Trade Agreement was that it would end Panama's financial crime secrecy protections and tax haven and money laundering activities. But what this leak shows is that, if anything, Panama's outrageous financial crime facilitation has intensified, while the free trade agreement's investor protections and official U.S. stamp of approval have increased inflows of dirty money to Panama. Now the same cast of characters is making equally outlandish promises of the benefits of the Trans-Pacific Partnership, while increasingly past supporters of these pacts are joining long-term critics and saying that not only will the TPP not deliver economic gains, but it will follow the pattern of past pacts and actually make things worse. Every day I like to pause and thank the people who provide the funding. None of it comes from offshore accounts that I know of. People take out subscriptions to the Peter B. Collins podcast, and folks send me $5, $10, $20 a month. Julie Dupree, Carla Mahoney, Casey Condon, and I also, they're monthly subscribers, and I want to make a special shout-out to our long-term supporter, Larry Duers, who last time we checked was an expatriate in Costa Rica. I noted that Larry just renewed his annual subscription again. So thank you one and all, and this is where I cue you, those of you who have not supported the Peter B. Collins podcast before. Come on over to peterbcollins.com. You click on the menu link, and then you click on Become a Subscriber. And with your PayPal account, you can choose $5, $10, $20 a month. The $50 annual subscription earns you a bonus book. I've got John Perkins' New Confessions of an Economic Hitman. I've got Joe Hickman's The Burn Pits, a really important expose. And for fun, we've got the user guide or field guide to the F word. You can choose one of those titles with your new annual subscription, and I'll be happy to send it to you if you're a new subscriber and located in the continental U.S. Well, score one for President Obama. He has shamed or prodded the Pfizer pharmaceutical giant into canceling its plans to move to Ireland to avoid American taxes. Now, you know, they weren't really going to move all their operations. They would just headquarter in Ireland through a reverse merger, and that is a recipe to avoid taxes. And, of course, you know, Apple Computer is one of the people, one of the companies that has paved the way for using Ireland for dodging American taxes. So Pfizer is going to have to pay $150 million to cancel the deal to the company called Allergan that they had planned to merge with. Allergan is already, they already reversed into an Irish HQ plan. Well, the American financial services company Morgan Stanley is blasting the Oscar-winning film The Big Short. They're blaming the movie for a reluctance among investors to sign up for subprime bonds. Now, I thought it was a great movie, and as you may know, the wonderful market makers on the street have been taking they've been taking consumer loans that are backed by the security of an automobile and bundling those into packages, just like they did with home mortgages. And they're having a hard time moving these bonds that are based on auto loans. And they're blaming Hollywood for that. Speaking of Hollywood, there's a powerful story in Vice News today. My friend and colleague Jason Leopold, working the Freedom of Information Act once again, has discovered some, not all, of the films, television, and book projects that have gotten a helping hand from the friendly folks at the Central Intelligence Agency. Now, we all know about Argo, I was going to say the line from the movie, but I'll stop, and Zero Dark Thirty. And I did not know that Bravo had a show called Top Chef Covert Cuisine. Also, the USA Cable Network series called Covert Affairs, the History Channel documentary Air America, the CIA's Secret Airline, and the BBC documentary The Secret War on Terror. All of these got special support from the CIA. Now, this is the result of a 20-page audit. It was originally released to another party last fall, but heavily redacted, and Leopold got a hold of a new copy where some of the stuff that was visible in the previous version is now redacted, and some of the stuff that was previously redacted is unredacted. And that's how he's come up with this list. So I think it's very interesting, and the audit really takes no position, it's a whitewash, on whether the CIA broke its own rules in collaborating with these propaganda projects. But I am particularly offended by the movie Zero Dark Thirty, which, of course, you know, drew in then CIA director Leon Panetta by choosing the Tony Soprano actor James Gandolfini to play Panetta in the film. And the amount of collusion there is one of the reasons that Dianne Feinstein got the bee up her butt and insisted on the torture report, because she felt that Zero Dark Thirty falsely showed its viewers that torture works. And at the time when Zero Dark Thirty was released, after I saw it, I said, this is propaganda on two fronts. It's propaganda about the work of the CIA and about the success of the use of torture. And so I think this is a fascinating read. I hope you'll take a look and watch your TV and films very skeptically in the future. Good news for Alan Grayson, the fiery congressman from Florida who is running for the open Senate seat that Marco Rubio vacated. And it was about a month or 6 weeks ago that I reported to you that he had been referred to the House Ethics Committee because of a hedge fund that he operates and, you know, some of the investment materials that he had published that were quite puffed up about Alan Grayson and his travels to look for distressed investment opportunities. And our loyal listener and pal, Ian Bremmer, he sent me some critical information about this, and he made some good points. Now, I'm happy to see that Grayson has essentially been cleared. The Ethics Committee is not forming a subcommittee to investigate him, and it means that this problem will likely go away and just become fodder for campaign commercials as he fights Conservadem Patrick Murphy for the Democratic nomination for the Senate seat there. The FBI is shopping around to law enforcement agencies across the country saying, hey, you got any iPhones we can open for you? Now, they are claiming that they successfully hacked the San Bernardino iPhone, but they're being coy about whether they produced any useful information. They're claiming, yes, we got information. But my hunch is, at this point, if they got anything that was useful, they'd be shouting it from the rooftops, making sure that we all know about it. I'm a little surprised the coal baron Don Blankenship has been sentenced to 1 year in state prison in West Virginia. Now, that is coal country, and to see a coal baron be sentenced to jail time is pretty surprising. Now, Blankenship sat through the trial of where he was accused of basically running the company in such a cheap way and cutting costs on safety regulations that he was responsible, at least via negligence, for the death of 29 people in the Upper Branch Mine event that was about 6 years ago. So Blankenship also is fined $250,000 and a year of probation after he is released from the big house. Mississippi is leading the charge now of this ridiculous trend of laws that are disguised as promoting religious liberty, but they really enact the religious liberty to discriminate against gays and lesbians and people who Bible thumpers don't like. So Phil Bryant, the governor of Mississippi, signed yesterday the bill called the Protecting Freedom of Conscience from Government Discrimination Act. See how Orwellian that is? They're saying basically that the Supreme Court rulings about gay marriage create a burden to people with religious beliefs, and therefore they're being discriminated against when they're told they can't discriminate against gays and lesbians and other people. And this is just pure bullshit. Desperate moves of people who can't believe that same-sex marriage is now legal across this country. And they're looking for any way they can possibly undermine it. In the great state of Tennessee yesterday, the governor signed a bill. Well, wait a minute. He hasn't signed it yet. The Senate voted 19-8 for a bill that makes the Bible the official state book of Tennessee. Now, the 50-caliber sniper gun is the official state rifle there. And I don't know what the state rock is or the state flower or the state bird, but they're claiming the Bible is their state book. Oh, and also in Mississippi, they announced that the new law puts In God We Trust in public places. So they're really pushing hard to impose religious values on people because they are acting like they have been victimized by secular America. It's just bizarre. The fine folks at PayPal, who I don't always agree with, but they do collect the money for subscribers at peterbcollins.com, they've made a good move. They have announced that they're canceling plans to build a new operation center in Charlotte, which would employ 400 skilled people in North Carolina. And they're doing it in retaliation for the law that preempted anti-discrimination laws across the state and protects bathrooms from people who need to take a leak. Also on the religious front, a group of Muslims have filed a lawsuit challenging the government's no-fly list. One of the plaintiffs is Yasin Kadura, an American citizen of Libyan descent. When he goes to an airport, he never knows what to expect. One time he was handcuffed and interrogated for hours when he tried to cross borders by land. He struggled to pick a medical school, unsure where he could travel. And when he tried to use Western Union, his transfers never went through. And he's actually been removed from the no-fly list. But the class action suit is being brought on behalf of him and other people, including a 4-year-old California boy who is listed as Baby John Doe. He has been on the no-fly list since he was 7 months old. That's how ridiculous this is. The other aspect is we've seen repeated cases where FBI agents have threatened to put people on the no-fly list if they didn't flip and become a snitch. These are police state activities, and that's why I responded so powerfully when last December President Obama said after the San Bernardino shootings that we should, not allow people on the no-fly list to purchase weapons. Well, I'd like to restrict weapons from a lot of people, but I don't support using the no-fly list as a basis for that. I recently reported to you that the lawyer for the late D.C. madam, his name is Sibley. What is his first name? Robert, maybe? I don't have it right in front of me here. So Sibley is the guy, Blair Sibley, I'm sorry. He is the guy who represented the D.C. madam. He has her phone records. He claims that they are really significant because they include repeated phone calls from a person who is currently a candidate for president of the United States. And he is demanding from two judges relief from essentially a gag order that restricts his legal ability to do this. So first, he went to Judge Merrick Garland, who is the chief judge of the circuit court there in Washington, D.C., and Merrick Garland rejected this special request from Blair Sibley. So he moved it on up the chain to the Chief Justice, John Roberts, and Roberts has denied the application to remove the restraining order which prohibits Sibley from releasing the phone records. And he had threatened that if they didn't respond to him, he was going to go ahead and release them. He is now saying that he's going to give the Supreme Court, I think, another week or two to reverse this decision by the Chief Justice, or he will then release the information. Yeah, it's weird. There's no question about it. It's weird. Thanks for listening to my news and comment podcast today. As always, I'll remind you, I don't charge for this podcast, and you are free to share it with absolutely everyone. So what's holding you back?
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling underneath.